and welcome to another edition of Football Memories and Moments. Thanks once again for everybody that's been listening. We're well into Series 5 now, and I think we're going to deliver a really another good chat with the chief football correspondent of the Times, Oliver Kay. Oliver's also written a book about a former Manchester United player called Adrian Doherty. And it was a really interesting chat. It was great to talk to him. I know I say that every week, but we're really quite grateful that the people can make their time to both be part of the podcast, but also yourselves putting your 40 to 50 minutes a time away to listen to us. We do appreciate that. I really enjoyed talking to Oliver. It took a little bit of organising. It is a Skype interview as well, so do have some patience with us, please. But you'll understand when you come to listen. It was great to chat to him. It was great to get a real general idea of how someone can go from falling in love to what he does, and the same grain of love for the game that he had at 6 years old that got him into it, that he has for a man in his early 40s who works in such a privileged position as well, as he rightly points out. And it was great to then go on and chat about something that was actually part of that formative, or certainly formed that early love of football, which was a great World Cup in Mexico 86. My thanks again to Kieran Mann for the intro music. Thanks again to my executive producer, Andrew Greaves. And again, thanks to yourselves for listening. And I really do hope you enjoy this chat with Oliver.
Well, I wanted to talk really about the process of memory of falling in love with football 6 years old, and it's a love affair that has endured. I'm 43 now, but I get so nostalgic and warm when I think back to the early 80s, and the summer of 1981 really was when I fell in love with football. And I think I've been at my grandma and granddad's house, and my older brother had left a football magazine, a Match or a Shoot, lying around, or a number of them. And he had always been into football, and I just thought of it as something that, bigger boys did, and I didn't really get it at that time. And then I remember just spending these few days just reading cover to cover this Match or Shoot magazine, and then being told that football season was starting a few weeks later, and suddenly there were all these football matches happening, and just being absolutely sort of wrapped up in this idea of football scores coming in and different matches to read about in Match and Shoot the following week. And I just became utterly obsessed very, very, very quickly, getting the looking at my brother's old sticker albums, then getting my own Panini 82, Football 82 album when that came out, starting going to matches with my parents and my older brother, and these league ladders things that came with Match and with Shoot, and just being absolutely, I just could not get enough of football. And whenever I hear about somebody's son or daughter getting into football, I always feel so envious of them, because it's, of the child, because there is no more exciting, thrilling moment than that as a young football fan, where you're just discovering things for the first time, and your eyes are being opened to the amazing world of football. And I think, from my point of view, being involved in football in some way was what I wanted to do from that age onwards. Obviously, I wanted to be a footballer, as a lot of kids do, but that was clearly never going to happen. And from quite a young age, just alarmingly early age, I probably thought of doing something like this, being a football writer, when I grew up, probably because I realised that it was a job where you wouldn't have to grow up.
I think that's a really interesting
way of putting it is that, you know, I've you know, worked. I mean, I'm out of football reporting at the moment, and I'm working on a sort of local news desk. But when it boils down to that aspect, isn't it, of you get paid to watch football? I mean, if you told your 6-year-old self that's your job, how do you think he would have coped?
I think he would have said, "What? So I'm not going to be playing?"
that's true.
And he would have burst into tears. But no. I mean, I've still got them in my loft at home. All these exercise books full of just, you know, things I was writing about matches then. You know, sort of writing out every team's 1 to 12 as it would have been, and writing out, you know, just copying from books, you know, what the record attendance was. It's such a little nerd, really. But so it perfect for this job. And doing these really, really long previews for the 1982 World Cup. But if I spent half as much time on schoolwork as I did on, I might have learned something. But it was. It was what I wanted to do from a young age. I would write reports on the very few matches that there would be on TV, but because there weren't very many at that time, it would just be FA Cup final, European Cup final, the European finals would be live on TV, and England matches. I think that first season, that was the only matches that were on TV, and then there was the World Cup. But I would write reports on them. You know, probably no worse than what I do now. I would also, you know, because there would be weeks between televised matches, I would then do reports on Subutio matches that I would play against myself. I mean, what a sado, but great times it's just that time in your life when you kind of you're just learning so much about football and what football is, and working out who plays for who, and I don't know. I mean, at that, well, now there's just so much information everywhere, and you couldn't possibly take all of it. I feel like at that time you stick a book, the top trumps, the league ladders and stuff like that. I just took in absolutely everything that I could, with match programs and stuff. I would just be reading and writing about football constantly. So I think I was probably destined to do something like this as a girl from quite an early age.
How do you think the 6-year-old you now, if you were, as you say, you're envious of the kids that you know from families and who are getting into football, how do you think the 6-year-old would cope with the amount of football going on? Do you think that you were benefited from the fact that you had to wait for a little bit more football to really reinforce that love of the game for yourself?
Yeah, I mean, you get kids who are sort of taken along to football matches when they're, well, I was going to say 4 or 5 years old, and you get some who are taken as you know, 1 or 2 months old, depending on what the parents, how the parents want to play it. And I, although I'm talking about summer of 81, the first match I ever went to see was in September 81, so only a month after this sort of coming of age or enlightenment, where I'd got into football. But it was. Even then, as a 6-year-old, I was desperate. I remember being desperate to go the previous weekend, saying, "Oh, what, you can actually go to matches? Can we go to a match? Can we go to a match?" And then I think it was like the third weekend of September. My dad took my brother and me to a match, and you know, we were. I grew up in Cheshire, and it was, well. It's always been the case, really, but at that particular time there were probably 7 top flight teams within, or 8 top flight teams within about an hour and a half of us, the two Merseyside clubs, two Manchester clubs, Stoke, West Brom, Wolves, Aston Villa, Birmingham as well, so nine. And my dad would sort of look in the paper at the fixtures on a Saturday morning. And you could do this then because there were tickets readily available. You couldn't possibly do it now, but he would sort of decide on, let's go to Everton against West Ham today. Let's go to Man United against Aston Villa today. Let's go to Wolves against Liverpool, whatever. It would be, and we just go down a motorway and we'd go and it would be amazing. It probably cost about £6 for the three of us or something like that. And I said, you can't do it now. But I remember that the first match we went to was Stoke against Nottingham Forest on a Saturday afternoon, 1981, September 1981. And it was just, again, like, I don't know, I wish you know now how everything is filmed and, you can see how kids react to opening their Christmas presents and going to Disneyland and stuff like that. I wish I had some kind of footage of me going into the Victoria Ground and Stoke for the first time or to Old Trafford or Anfield or Villa Park or wherever for the first time. I just remember just being absolutely gobsmacked every time, just seeing this huge, felt huge at the time, stadium in the distance. You'd see the floodlights, you'd go in, you'd squeeze through the turnstiles and you'd go up what felt like, the biggest staircase or up and up staircases. And then you'd find yourself at the top of the stand and you'd look down onto this pitch, which I know we always say that pitches back in that day were like bogs and quagmires and stuff, but I remember looking at those pictures and thinking, wow, I've never seen anything so green as those first pictures you see, because obviously it's not like the pitch in your local park. The noises of the crowd, the smells, the smell of really thick cigarette smoke. And even now, if it's somewhere else in the world, if I go into a pub where you're still allowed to smoke in different countries, and I get that sort of thick fog of cigarette smoke, which should absolutely turn your stomach, it just instinctively reminds me of going to football matches in the 80s, and it's a great feeling, and then I have to just cover my nose and probably leave. Just that sort of assault on the senses, with the sounds, the smells, the sights, of going to football matches the first time. I wish that's something you could bottle as a memory and preserve it, and revisit it. But I mean, those memories are so sharp in my mind. The first time at that first game at the Victoria Ground at Stoke and first games at Goodison and Anfield and Main Road and Old Trafford and the Midlands clubs and so on. It was just really, really great times. And I look back on that era so, so fondly. The smells, I remember so clearly and so vividly from going to these different grounds. And even now, if I go abroad and go to a country where you can still smoke in bars and stuff like that, that strong smell, that inescapable smell of sort of cheap tobacco, just reminds me of going to football matches in the 80s and come out stinking of cigarette smoke and the smells of horse dung outside and fish and chips. It's just, these are the smells that remind you of football matches, the noises that remind you of it. And it's, I don't know whether it's we always use that word sanitised now about going to football grounds, but the whole experience doesn't feel like a kind of assault on the senses in the way that it did back then. That, you know, the sounds, the smells, the noise. It just felt, it just felt different back then. A lot more raw. And I think maybe your senses are heightened growing up rather than when you're 43 years old and you've been to probably thousands of football matches. Maybe everything just feels a bit more the same. Whereas those memories of growing up and going to all of those grounds for, you know, the first time, the second time, the third time, I just love looking back on those memories.
Do you still get that feeling? I mean, I've been going to, you know, it's the followers of this podcast, you know, it's no surprise I'm an Evertonian to them. The feeling I get walking up the steps of the Clatter Street, I don't think that has changed since my first game as a 7-year-old. Do you still get that same sense? Whatever ground it is that you go to, I know, you know, you don't want to disclose who you support, and I completely agree with that. But when you go to that ground, do you still have those same sensations? Not so much always the smell, but just that same sort of almost chemical reaction in yourself.
Yeah, and it's not the same as I mean, you're doing this job for, I mean, I've been for times alone, 18 years now, and you become a lot more dispassionate about it. You become a lot more professional about how you do it. But you mentioned Goodison. I mean, Goodison has changed least, I would say, out of all of those. I mean, out of the grounds I've reeled off, I mean, Villa Park and Molineux and Anfield and Old Trafford and Main Road and Victoria Ground, which have gone, obviously. But of those grounds I used to go to as when I was young, Goodison is the one that has changed least by far. You walk down, is it Goodison Road, by the Winslow pub or hotel, or whatever they call it, it's a tight road, you know, a tight walk on that road, and it's all those things I mentioned, the horse dung, the fish and chips. That feels like going to the a match in the '80s, and I'm sure there are Everton executives who feel that that's absolutely what has to change. But I love going to Goodison Park. It is just, I did a whole column about that a couple of years ago, about how about Goodison Park and how the fact that it hasn't changed just makes it so special. And I know that brings limitations and restrictions for a club and for a company and all that kind of thing. But I'm always very nostalgic when these old grounds are, you know, reduced to rubble, and I don't have the same attachment with White Hart Lane or with Upton Park or with, you know, Middlesbrough and Sunderland and Derby and places like that that have gone. But you know, when Goodison goes, that will be a very sad day. I'm not an Evertonian. I'm just saying it will be a very sad day, and it will be one of those grounds really, really special.
I completely agree. But in a way, it's good that when you look at Liverpool and United, the way that they have been able to, I mean, United's been a lot easier. Liverpool is obviously, there's a bit more associated with their redevelopment of Anfield, but you kind of have to take your hat off to them and say, you know, well done for maintaining what is their spiritual home. And it's what it is. I mean, I listened to Five Live years ago about an afternoon conversation about what ghosts actually are, and I never thought I'd go down this angle, but ghosts are actually the maintenance or maintaining, sorry, of memories, of physical memories by buildings, and you know, when you think of it in that way, it just makes sort of the likes of Old Trafford, the likes of Anfield, the likes of Villa Park, which, you know, has been redeveloped, it just makes those experiences more beautiful, doesn't it? Well, sorry, in my view.
No, it does, and I mean, Old Trafford, although, I mean, it's still got the, they built it up brilliantly, they've developed Old Trafford brilliantly, but it suddenly feels like a 1990s stadium, or it feels like a, I imagine Old Trafford will have to be tarted up a bit over the next sort of 10, 15 years or so. But Anfield now feels like a modern stadium in a way that it really didn't 10 years ago. Whereas Goodison, I think its charm is that it does feel like a throwback, and it's almost like going to some of those, you know, lower league grounds. It's clearly a far better stadium, far more prestigious, bigger stadium, etc. But you go to somewhere like Boundary Park, Oldham, somewhere like that, and that feels like a throwback. Goodison feels like a throwback, like it's been frozen in time, and it's I don't know. I mean, I'm aware of all the reasons why they need to. Why as a club it's not viable to stay at Goodison, but I wish they would, because I will really miss it when it's gone. And I say that as there is no worse press box in the Premier League, I can tell you that, in terms of it being absolutely cramped. It makes a Ryanair flight look like so cramped up there.
One of the biggest feats of engineering I've ever seen, and biological engineering in my life, that there's, I mean, I'm not a small lad, but there's two members of a football league called Social Media who, to put it euphemistically, are big boys. Mm-hmm. And I watched in absolute awe about 7 years ago when these two lads squeezed into the rows in Goodison's press box. And I was there in a professional-ish capacity, but I didn't really have anything to file. And I just spent the whole game watching those two move in and out. So I kind of know what you mean. And obviously back to Boundary Park, I think that's just a throwback to the Ice Age more than any football stadium. Yeah. When did you think you became aware of the overlap between Oliver Kay, the young boy, then young man, teenager, etc., who loves football, to the more professional side? What was that overlap like, and has that overlap ever gone away for you?
What you mean? You mean when did I sort of first become aware that there was a possibility of doing this?
Yeah, but also when did that overlap into actually I'm here to do to write my runner. I'm here to write my leader. And I can't take in the sort of beauty of what's going on. Has that overlap ever come in, or do you still maintain your childish love of being able to go to a football game?
Oh no, I still definitely maintain that childish love of it, and I probably don't have quite the kind of giddy excitement that I did as a 6, 7, 8 year old, or my early 20s, doing this as a job for first time. But I, if I'm going to a match, particularly one of the grounds I mentioned, it's something I really look forward to. I mean, obviously there's things. I could permanently stick in traffic on the West End and Old Trafford. I can sympathise with Manchester United arriving late there for nearly all our recent home games, because the traffic out there is a nightmare. But it's you are there to do a job. You don't just spend the whole time gazing in and gawking at your surroundings and being like a kind of wide-eyed kid in a toy shop. But you have to retain that sense of privilege and excitement at what you're doing, and you have to enjoy it. I'd say it's one of those jobs that if you weren't enjoying it, enjoy going to games and meeting people and the thrill of going to different grounds and so on, it'd be a stupid job to have, because in terms of the hours you work, I mean, people might imagine it's a few hours on a Saturday afternoon and a few on a Tuesday night, but it's nothing like that. It's round the clock. It's very unsociable hours. You don't get to see your family as much as you like. You don't get to see your friends as much as you like. So if that childish excitement wasn't there, you would be in the wrong job, really. But yeah, it definitely is, and I hope it never leaves me. It's 37 years of having sort of football pumped into my veins every week, every day, pretty much, and yet, if I think of, I mean, God knows how many thousands of football matches I've been to, but if there was one time that I wish I could just be transported to and be there in body rather than watching TV, it's the 1986 World Cup, which I just absolutely loved. I mean, I was 11 years old, and I'd loved the 1982 World Cup as a 7-year-old who just couldn't believe that there was suddenly two football matches on every day, having probably seen two matches on TV all season, and got really into the sort of, I think all of my, or 99% of the sort of geography of the world that I know was developed by watching World Cups. But it's so coming across that, you know, having a World Cup just dropping into my lap as a 7-year-old was amazing. I didn't really know it was going to happen, and I got incredibly excited about it. But then by the time the next World Cup in Mexico, 4 years later, the sense of anticipation that I had as a 11-year-old was just so enormous. I was so ludicrously excited for months and months and months beforehand. And, you know, collecting the stickers and wall charts and all that kind of thing. I don't think I've ever looked forward to anything in my life more than I look forward to it. The opening game was Bulgaria and Italy, and I remember we had a friend's birthday party. I think it was a Friday night or a Saturday night. There was a friend's birthday party at school, and we were all around at his, and we watched this game. It was a 1-1 draw, and I can remember both the goals. I can't remember an awful lot more about it apart from just being incredibly excited, and just for the next 4 weeks, really, I was just. And the thing about that World Cup is that half the matches seem to kick off at 7 p.m. UK time, and half of them, I think, kicked off at 7 p.m. So, for example, the England-Portugal game, and the England-Morocco game, and the England-Poland game, all of England's group games kicked off at, I think, 11 p.m. UK time, or maybe midnight, I can't remember, but it was... it was too late for an 11-year-old boy to start. So I'd get into this routine of sort of getting up at 6 o'clock and recording these matches and watching them, you know, right the way through in the morning, and being absolutely devastated watching that first England game on repeat, not knowing the score when England lost. The late goal to Portugal, and then the next one, they drew 0-0 with Morocco, and Ray Wilkins sent off. And it just seemed like it was his most disastrous World Cup campaign, and it ended up a relatively memorable, a relatively uplifting World Cup campaign. But it was, my memories aren't really about England with that World Cup. It's about Maradona. About Denmark. That Denmark team were amazing. Laudrup and Elkjær and Jesper Olsen, Jan Molbeek, Morten Olsen, just, and the kit that they had, the Hummel kit with the thick red on one half and then the stripes on the other, which seemed like the coolest kit anybody had ever seen, made by Hummel. And the France team with Platini and Thiganat and Fernandez, and who was the other one in midfield? Tigana, Fernandez, Jerez,
yeah.
Amazing midfield. And Brazil, it had all been about Brazil for me in 1982, and they were the ones who really excited me. But by 86, I'd say France and Denmark and Argentina excited me more. But it was just, I'd get up as I say, I'd get up early to watch those games, early in the morning, and they were, some of them were dire, but I would still happily sit through these 0-0 draws, awful games, and just be absolutely awestruck, really, by how I was able to watch football at 6 o'clock in the morning and see all these guys who had been in my Panini sticker book, and it was just I just absolutely loved that experience. And I'd say I was already deeply dangerously obsessed by football, but that only increased with the 86 World Cup, and I just could not get enough of it. I think I probably watched several of those matches many times over. And there was a video appeared on Twitter a few months ago. It was like the BBC's goal of the tournament, top 20. And God knows how many times I must have watched that, because not only could I know all the goals as they were unfolding, I could, even the less memorable ones, Edinho for Brazil, it was well worth moving a little back at you, cut off his right foot, scored, lovely goal. I just remembered all of those goals as soon as I saw the names, and I could probably remember half the goals that didn't get into that top 20, and I remember the commentaries sort of off by heart. It's that age where everything is so incredibly exciting, and one of my nephews he was the same age, 11, going through this World Cup, and I think he would be the same with that. I think he just got so utterly deeply obsessed by it. But I guess the difference now is that now you've got football on round the clock, every evening there are matches on, every weekend there are 10 matches you can choose from, whereas that particular season, 85-86, there wasn't even match of the day the first half of the season because of a dispute between the broadcasters and the Football League. I think there've been about 6 or 7 matches on live in the second half of the season, and then suddenly you had the World Cup, and it was just incredibly exciting. And then, of course, at the heart of it all, there's Diego Maradona, who was I find it difficult, the Maradona Messi comparison, but for that 4 weeks was just unplayable, like nothing I've ever seen before or since. And in the school playground, I was still, I think Maradona was basically sort of vilified by the whole of the country, but I still wanted to be Maradona even after that quarterfinal. I was sort of stumbling over the ball and saying Maradona, but he was just incredible. And
I mean, I think we'll look at Maradona in and that game, and there's three bits of Maradona to look at towards the end. But I just want to come back to exactly what you said about your nephew, and what's interesting, your view of the 86 World Cup, how you the build up to it, and then the games. Is similar that in the South Africa World Cup, I had just turned 30, so a slight difference between 11, although I'm not overly certain there was much mental age difference. And I was unemployed at that time. I had time off, and I got really excited for the World Cup, and I watched all three games. I mean, the first day of in 2006 of realising it was three games a day was just a sensational feeling.
Yeah.
But I hope it doesn't go beyond that in going forward. But if you were an 11-year-old watching the 2010 World Cup, it could have put you off football, isn't it? And ultimately, World Cups are ultimately what dictate an increase or decrease in the love of football. I don't care about participation, but I mean, it is ultimately, as much as we love club football and club football's all that, a good World Cup does make football fans pair, doesn't it?
It does, and it's as you say, it's that gateway for a lot of people. If you want to put it in those terms, it's something that Probably hooks in a lot of people who otherwise would not be so interested in the week-to-week shenanigans in the Premier League. It's probably hard to sort of dip into the Premier League in November and get quite as deeply into it as you can if exposed to a World Cup at the right age. But that 2010 World Cup was a terrible World Cup, and I was really excited about doing that. It was the first one I'd done as chief football correspondent at the Times, and I was embedded in the England team, and it was just such a negative experience in terms of football. It was good journalistically because there were a lot of stories, there was a lot of chaos behind the scenes with England and disharmony, but it just felt like it shouldn't really feel reporting on a World Cup. We were in this place in a bit of a tangent, but we were in this place in Sun City in South Africa, which sounds amazing. It had golf courses, it had casinos, it had restaurants. It was like this kind of centre park for adults in sort of on the outskirts of Rustenburg. It was basically the only place they could find to put up a load of journalists within commuting distance of England's training camp, which was in the middle of nowhere. And that experience was really, really strange because, although, I mean, it got cold and dark about 5 p.m. because it was winter there.
Yeah.
And we were in this place that had all these, it had water parks, golf courses, etc. And because you're there to do the job, because you're working round the clock from first thing in the morning to 10 at night, I don't think any of the guys went in the water park. I think a few of them went to play golf one day after England got knocked out, but that World Cup experience was about as far removed from my sort of childish excitement of 1982 and 86. It probably wasn't, just to get back to your question, you could get kids who off football.
Sorry, Oliver, you just went a little bit sunken there.
Okay, sorry.
So, to go back to the question.
So just to get back to the question, you could get kids who were coming, for whom that 2010 World Cup would have been a defining moment, and it probably would have inspired them in anything like the same way as you say, the 82 World Cup, the 86 World Cup, and the 2018 World Cup, which was really, really good. I mean, I'm sure there are kids growing up in Germany who feel like it was a terrible World Cup. But it was a World Cup which ticked pretty much every box in terms of a spectacle, and I'd say maybe it didn't have quite the same sense of one amazing team coming to the fore or one amazing individual coming to the fore, but I'd say what Maradona did in 86 hasn't been repeated and probably is unlikely to be repeated in this sort of club focused, club driven age where it's so incredibly difficult for even guys like Messi and Ronaldo to repeat their club form on the international stage.
So for people who aren't quite sure of 86, even though it is one of the best World Cup films, and if you can get out there on YouTube to watch it, or even get it in off Amazon or whatever it is, because of the picture, and you got that a little bit in USA 94 because again the type of cameras they used. But you've got, Maradona is pretty much famous for three things. Two of them come in one game, well in one half, never mind one game, and the rest is that reading the, I can't remember the author, but the recent book about Italian 90.
Yeah.
Which was really, really enjoyable, and go out and get that where you can as well. I'll put it in the intro. It talks about Maradona trying to recreate that, and there's an element where he was in such peak physical condition, despite he was getting volleyed every week.
Mm-hmm.
He dragged Argentina to that tournament win by just being a sheer force of nature, didn't he?
He did. I mean, look, people kind of make out that it was single-handedly done, and that, that it was that they were a bunch of journeymen apart from Maradona. I mean, that's not quite the case. I think Valdano, I think, was already at Real Madrid and scoring a lot of goals for Real Madrid, so he was no slouch. Burishaga was a very good player, but it was a fairly rugged team otherwise. Ruggeri, the name that sounds like rugged. He was a tough guy, central defender, and it was it was a team that looked quite ordinary at various stages. And I think when England came up against them in the quarterfinal, there was a sense that Argentina had scraped past past Uruguay in the previous round, and England had suddenly come to life and played against played well against Poland and Paraguay and beaten them both 3-0. I think there was a sense that this was playing Maradona plus 10, and Maradona hadn't he'd had a very good tournament to that point, but he hadn't completely unplayable, and there was a feeling that England could win that game, and yet Maradona's performance. Look, I can't really remember the first half of that game well, apart from I would say that England were probably giving him a bit of a kicking and not giving him any space and doing what you could within the laws at that time with Terry Fenwick and Terry Butcher and guys, tough guys, central defenders again, and Peter Reid was no doubt sticking tight to him in midfield. But then there was the handball, which ended the stalemate. And I think as a 11-year-old, I just watched that and with my dad and my certainly one brother, probably two brothers, and I think we were just sort of in shock that he handled the ball into the net, and it got picked up sort of almost immediately by the TV, and then we were just sort of thinking, how can the referee not see that? How can he do that? How can he not own up to it? But within whatever it was, 10-15 minutes, when he scored his second goal, it was just so unbelievably good that, I know all the papers the next day were full of the handball, and it feels like England as a country has still never forgiven or forgotten that handball. But
Peter Shilton specifically.
Well, Peter Shilton definitely has. But the goal, looking back dispassionately, 32 years later, I'd say that goal makes me forgive everything. It was just an incredible goal from a guy who was, in that film you mentioned that how much it meant to him and to Argentina. But to be able to do that, score that goal, I know Messi scored a couple of similar ones over the years, and there have been a number of other amazing individual goals. But that goal, in terms of the size of the moment, the significance of the game, all the sort of political dimension to it from the Falklands a few years earlier, and just to seize a moment like that, to score a goal like that, where you're just... I was speaking to another journalist a few years back, and he said, if you watch that game, not actually that good, because he doesn't really... There's not like a trick, or he's just kind of drifting away from players, drifting away from Peter Reid. He's kind of gliding in between. It's not as good as such and such a goal. And look, technically you could say there are, I remember Neymar scoring an absolutely incredible goal when he was in Brazil. I won't attempt to get the name again because I'll get it wrong, but which was probably one of the technically best goals I've ever seen. But in terms of moment plus technique plus, I guess, legacy, that Maradona goal is for me the best I've ever seen, or the favourite goal I've ever seen. My favourite goal, even though it was against England, and then he scored a, I mean, not as good, but a comparable goal in the quarterfinal, semi-final against Belgium, which was also incredible, and he's just sort of a ball of energy as he's drifting past his challenges, and then he hits it as he's falling off balance, and it's just absolutely amazing. And yes, he was actually fairly quiet in the final by his standards, but he still produced that amazing pass for Bershaga to go through and score the winner in what was, after a really poor first half, a very dramatic, entertaining second half of probably one of the best World Cup finals of my lifetime. I mean, there haven't been many great ones. Look back at this summer, France and Croatia, and 6 goals, but I'm still not convinced it was a great game. But that second half of Argentina, West Brom, Argentina, who would Claudio Jakob play for? Argentina was dramatic, and again, one of those things I kept on video and watched for years and years and years. Just one other thing about that World Cup, which made it feel all the more exotic, was the shape and the design of the goal nets. As ludicrous as that sounds, when you're, they weren't the sort of standard goal nets that in English football that you see now. I mean, some with stanchions, some with not, some with the big poles. But those goal nets, which were the nets seemed to go almost as far back as they did, as they were wide. It was, and every goal as it flew into the net just looked beautiful. As the nets themselves, they weren't that sort of springy. They were, it seemed like everything just nestled beautifully into the net. It was loads of goals coming through my mind. Igor Belanov for Russia against Soviet Union against Belgium, and Vasily Rats for Soviet Union against Hungary, I think it was. Josimar, the great Josimar, who, I don't think his career was all that great, but for probably a week in 1986, he was the best player in the world, in my opinion. And Michael Laudrup against Uruguay in the group stage. Brilliant individual goal. And I'm almost getting shivers down my spine as I remember all of these moments. It was just spellbinding. It felt spellbinding to me as an 11-year-old kid. And if the 11-year-old me had been able to be parachuted into that, some of those matches and just watch them live, I think that would have been, I think that would have been unbeatable.
Well, there you go. That's the end of that. And thanks again to Ollie for his time. He really was quite patient as we had a couple of technical issues, a couple of internet issues, as you can tell with the Skype. But I think what really came through there was a real love for football. And that's ultimately, it's been in our bio since day one that, we want to speak to people who have a common thread of and a common theme and a common love of football. So I really enjoyed that. I hope you did too. Mexico 86. There is on YouTube, if we remember to on social media, there's weeks between this being recorded and going out. So, quite frankly, you try and remember all that stuff. But on YouTube, there is 4 parts of every single goal of the Mexico 86 World Cup. So on behalf of Ollie and I, we really enjoy the idea of you just disappearing for 4 hours and watching that. Thanks again to everyone that's listened. Please, if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, do give us a rating, a 5-star rating, if you could. It just helps us get noticed a bit more, and that would be really helpful, because I think we're telling good stories here on Football Memories and Moments, and it would be nice if those stories could be heard a bit more. Have a great week.